this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour. Today is July 23rd. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyenkehaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back on 90.3 FM.
Radio. Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
It's the second week in a row that Quebec has reported an increase in the number of weekly COVID-19 cases to 76 on July 22nd. This increase comes after a dip in cases in April. Health officials say that the rise in the number of cases is being driven by the 20 to 29-year-olds and where vaccination is low. 54% of Quebecers 12 and older are fully vaccinated. And Canada announced it will allow fully vaccinated Americans to enter the country starting August 9th. Air Canada is planning roughly 220 flights per day for U.S. tourists who want to enter the country. The U.S. border still remains closed to all Canadian tourists, including those who are fully vaccinated. And a blue fence has been put up on the corner of Milton and Park in the last week, in addition to the one that was already there. The corner has been a common gathering place for homeless residents of the borough, most of whom are Inuit. The coordinator of the Open Door Shelter, John Tessier, and community groups say adding the second fence will increase the likelihood of life-threatening situations for those who call that corner home. The group Meals for Milton Park says the city must take down the fences that they say push people out onto the street even more than before. They've created a petition to ask the city to take the fence down immediately, among other calls for support. The city says that they have no jurisdiction over the fence because it was put up by a private company. And Quebec wants to hold two test concerts this fall to see the effects of their COVID health measures. The concerts will be in the Quebec City region, and participants will be monitored by health officials and researchers following the gatherings. The province put out calls for potential artists on Monday. You're listening to CKUT on 90.3 FM. Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m. My name is Brian Jefferson. Up first on this episode of Off the Hour.
Hector Toblank Park was a meeting place, or a launching point for a week of action. Sunday was the first day of 7 days of events like protests, rallies, organized by Solidarity Across Borders. It's a grassroots group here in Montreal whose members are undocumented migrants, community supporters, and activists. They're dedicating this week to call on the federal government to grant status for everyone. The regularization process in Quebec takes considerably longer than it does for other provinces. Some people have been waiting for residency for over 8 years, and that's a common story. Solidarity Across Borders held actions meant to raise awareness about how status affects every single part of someone's life. For example, If we're talking about Montreal's housing crisis, social housing is the solution for some. Municipal and provincial government programs, though, for social housing exclude those who are not citizens or permanent residents. On the corner of Avenue Hope and René Lévesque, the crowd that's listening to music, sharing ideas, and talking like friends turns their attention to a man with a mic standing by a black truck and four other people.
Hello,
let's listen.
Welcome, everybody. Bonjour. Bonjour, chers camarades. On veut juste vous demander de vous rapprocher un peu du camion. On va s'apprêter à avoir quelques témoignages de nos camarades. Et tout de suite après, on va se mettre en marche et crier le slogan sur tous les toits. D'abord, je voudrais dire bonjour à tout le monde. Est-ce que tout le monde entend? Est-ce que tout le monde va bien? Est-ce que l'esprit est fort?
Ok, merci, merci beaucoup. On va juste commencer vite fait avec Samira. Elle va souhaiter la bienvenue à tout le monde et puis introduire le plan.
Bonjour à tous, merci d'avoir répondu oui à notre invitation. Solidarité sans frontières est un réseau impliqué dans la lutte migrante actif à Montréal depuis 2003. Nos revendications principales sont la fin des détentions et des déportations et l'opposition à la double peine. Un statut pour tous et toutes. Nous travaillons pour créer une cité sans frontières. En partenariat avec le réseau des droits migrants et beaucoup de nos autres alliés, dont Centre des travailleurs et migrants et Soigner la justice sociale, nous organisons une semaine d'action partout à Montréal pour réclamer un programme de régularisation pour tous et toutes. Nous allons commencer ici à Montréal pour terminer ensuite devant le bureau du Premier ministre à Ottawa. Depuis le début de la pandémie, on a fait beaucoup d'actions pour souligner la précarité des gens suite à ce virus qui a frappé le monde entier, y a diminué même les plus forts et a rendu vulnérables les personnes sans statut. Nous, les immigrants à situation précaire, avons commencé avec la grande manifestation du 4 juillet à Émile-Gamelin l'été dernier, puis devant le 10-10 Saint-Antoine pour briser la peur, ensuite devant le bureau du Justin Trudeau pour montrer qu'on est tous essentiels et beaucoup d'autres manifestations. Malheureusement, on n'a pas vu un changement, juste des petits programmes de régularisation limités qui nous ont tous exclus. Beaucoup de nos amis et proches ont été exclus par le programme des anges gardiens. Puis cette semaine, à peine 10 semaines après son ouverture, le volet travailleurs essentiels du nouveau programme d'immigration a fermé, laissant derrière lui des centaines de milliers de migrants sans statut. Cette semaine, nous avons également appris que le Canada a rejeté le double du nombre de demandes humanitaires d'immigration que 2020. La demande de résidence permanente pour des raisons humanitaires est la seule avenue vers la résidence permanente pour la plupart des personnes migrantes sans statut. Assez, c'est assez. Le système cas par cas nous fait violence. Nous avons besoin d'un vrai programme de régularisation pour tout le monde. Cette semaine, nous lançons une semaine d'action avant de nous rendre à Ottawa pour exprimer nos revendications. Nous allons présenter une demande humanitaire symbolique à Ottawa pour toutes les personnes avec un statut précaire au Canada, des personnes sans papier, des réfugiés, des étudiants et étudiantes étrangères, des aides familiaux et des travailleurs agricoles. L'union fait la force, un statut pour tous et toutes.
Merci, merci, merci beaucoup, Samira. Ouais. Tout de suite après, je vais juste donner la parole à Dunia avant qu'on va faire l'introduction de notre plan de déroulement de la semaine. Bienvenue Dunia et la parole est à toi.
Bonjour tout le monde, je me présente, moi c'est Dunia, je suis une demandeur d'asile. Je suis sans résultat en attente, ça fait 3 ans et demi. Je suis épicière au métro, je fais l'ouverture le matin, je prépare les commandes. Le service à la clientèle, le nettoyage, je désinfecte, je sors la poubelle et je fais la fermeture aussi. Moi aussi, j'ai travaillé pendant la pandémie. Je faisais des heures supplémentaires alors que les Québécois sont restés chez eux confinés et ont touché aussi la PCU. Moi, j'ai pas bénéficié. Moi, j'ai risqué ma vie et celle de ma famille en prenant l'autobus, en préparant vos commandes et en la livrant chez vos parents vulnérables et vos familles aussi, pour qu'il ne vous manque rien à vous et à tous ceux qui vivent au Canada. C'est pour ça que je demande le statut
mes enfants. Depuis si longtemps que j'ai pas vu mes enfants. À cause de la séparation. À cause de la séparation de mes enfants, j'ai piqué une dépression majeure. Même être hospitalisée. Nous ne pouvons plus attendre. Nous avons besoin d'un statut pour tous et toutes. Merci.
Merci. Merci, merci pour ton témoignage courageux. Merci pour ton témoignage. Et c'est vraiment la raison pour laquelle elle est vraiment un exemple patent de ce que les migrants y vivent. Ils sont délaissés, ils sont tout seuls, ils sont face à cette pandémie et sans l'aide de personne. Donc c'est ce qui nous motive. Et puis on va continuer le combat pour nous tous et ça va aller. Et puis on va aller jusqu'à Ottawa. Et puis on va dénoncer tout ça, on va prendre des mesures qu'il faut prendre, et puis on va continuer le combat, on va appeler encore plus le monde. T'inquiète pas, tout va aller. Ouais, on est tous avec toi. Ouais. Et ouais, vas-y.
Maintenant on demande un autre témoignage de la fille de Donia. Merci.
Bonjour, moi c'est Aya, j'ai 14 ans. Normalement je suis au secondaire, mais j'ai refait ma classe d'accueil 3 fois à cause de mes troubles psychologiques. Suite à leur situation ici au Canada, l'absence de mes deux frères, qui me manquent beaucoup, et la tristesse que je ressens sur le visage de mes parents, qui travaillent sans relâche pour subvenir à nos besoins. Je me suis renfermée sur moi-même. J'ai toujours entendu que le Canada est un pays de paix et de justice. Pourquoi je vois toujours ma mère en train de pleurer? Jusqu'à quand cette situation va durer? Tant de questions qui n'ont pas de réponse. Monsieur Trudeau, moi aussi je demande un statut pour tous, tous et toutes. Monsieur Trudeau, moi aussi je mérite la résidence permanente.
Merci.
Bravo, merci.
Merci pour ton courage. Merci.
Un autre témoignage de la part de Mohamed Bari.
Bonjour tout le monde. Comme ma collègue vient de le dire, je m'appelle Mohamed Bari. Je suis membre de Solidarité Sans Frontières. Je suis aussi membre de CTI, le comité guinéen uni pour un statut. Mais là, aujourd'hui, je porte la casquette du comité guinéen. Je vais vous raconter le vécu des Guinéens au Canada et un peu mon expérience. Personnel ici au Canada depuis que je suis là. En fait, je rappelle tout d'abord que personne ne souhaite d'être réfugié, mais il le devient pour une raison individuelle ou collective. Chacun aimerait vivre ce soir, mais des circonstances horribles nous obligent à quitter nos pays pour venir au Canada dans l'espoir d'avoir une vie paisible et sécuritaire. Malheureusement, on a oublié tous nos rêves de faire des études de grandes universités au profit du système canadien machiavélique qui nous enfonce dans une précarité interminable. De nombreux Guinéens et Guinéennes vivent ici et travaillent ici au Canada depuis plusieurs années, bien intégrés dans la société où ils vivent. On a réussi à construire un grand réseau d'amis et d'alliances. On a fait le Canada de chez nous à cause de notre implication dans le développement économique, social et culturel pour le bien-être de ce pays et de sa société. Malgré tous ces efforts considérables, nos demandes d'asile sont refusées en masse pour tout simplement des calculs politiques du gouvernement de Justin Trudeau et de François Legault. Des fois même des étudiants internationaux guinéens qui ont fini leurs études après avoir dépensé des milliers de dollars dans les universités canadiennes, se retrouvent dans des situations difficiles. Malgré leur diplôme canadien, alors que le Canada a un accord bilatéral de commerce avec la Guinée, il est aussi signataire de plusieurs conventions internationales qui stipulent avec de respecter les droits humains. Mais les droits des demandeurs d'asile guinéens ne sont pas respectés au Canada. Des compagnies canadiennes exploitent nos minerais tels que l'or, le diamant, la bauxite depuis plusieurs décennies telles que la compagnie Sémaphore Guinée et la SNCF Lavalin. Mais le Canada ne s'intéresse qu'à nos ressources minérales et non aux Guinéens. Le Canada nous déporte dans un pays sans État où les droits humains n'existent même pas. Il n'y a pas de séparation entre les pouvoirs exécutifs, législatifs et judiciaires. Toutes les institutions sont inféodales au président de la République. L'impunité, la corruption sont institutionnelles et administratives. Et le taux de chômage dépasse même 60%. Des manifestations politiques violemment réprimées. La torture des opposants emprisonnés est quotidienne. Ils n'ont même pas droit à une visite de leurs proches ou avocats. Alpha Condé et son gouvernement ne reculent devant rien pour atteindre leurs objectifs. Après les élections présidentielles d'octobre 2020, il y a eu plus de 250 personnes qui ont été tuées par balles à bout portant, la plupart à leur domicile, la nuit en train de dormir. Des femmes, des enfants, des bébés de 2 ans ou de 3 ans ont été tués. Ils ont démoli de plus de 4000 maisons et des buildings appartenant à des opposants, juste à cause de leur politique, à leur opinion politique. Même tout est documenté par Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International et un département américain qui a même suspendu l'aide militaire pour la Guinée. Le Canada fait une sourde oreille. Certains membres du gouvernement guinéen et leurs familles sont ici au Canada, comme Papa Koli Kourouma et Diané. Nous demandons au Canada, qui est un état de droit, de ne pas collaborer avec des criminels. Nous demandons l'arrêt immédiat de la déportation vers la Guinée et vers tout un autre pays. Nous demandons une régularisation complète pour tous les immigrants au Canada, sans exception, d'accélérer les dossiers qui attendent les parrainages et les gens leurs familles se réunissent. Donc, je vous remercie. Merci.
Merci beaucoup. Merci beaucoup pour votre parole.
After they shared about how status affects them, like being separated from their families as they wait for the slow Canadian regularization process to be completed, or they take precarious jobs, the group of around 100 people marched. They gathered together 3 more times throughout this week. And this upcoming weekend, on Saturday and Sunday, Solidarity Across Borders is taking a bus to knock on the doors of the federal government themselves to demand status for everyone. CKUT will have your coverage next week. You're tuned into Off the Hour.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
It takes a good dose of courage and perseverance to get through a pandemic.
True, but it also takes a good dose of patience, resilience, confidence, optimism, humor, and love. Not to mention a dose of determination, endurance, empathy, motivation, hope, and ingenuity.
But above all, it takes a second dose of vaccine.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
And let's check in with Land Back Lane. This next segment was made by podcasters from Embers. We'll have local Montreal news that you can use at the top of the hour.
You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
Nothing ever burns down by itself. Every fire.
Hello, welcome to From Embers. We recently took almost a whole year off from recording this show, and there are so many amazing struggles that we have missed out on talking about during that time. One of those is a land reclamation on the edge of the Six Nations of the Grand River Reserve near Caledonia, Ontario. This week marks the one-year anniversary of the camp known as 1492 Landback Lane, which was reclaimed last July in response to plans to develop a subdivision on Six Nations territory. The Six Nations Reserve is the largest reserve in so-called Canada by population, and sits in the midst of one of the most densely populated regions in the country. The reserve has shrunk drastically from the land tract originally promised to the Haudenosaunee after the American Revolutionary War, all as settler development in what is now known as Southern Ontario has continued to sprawl. Six Nations people have stood up to defend their territory from development on numerous occasions, including a now famous standoff in 2006 that led to the reclamation of the site known as Gunnestaddin, or the Protected Place, and the cancellation of the Douglas Creek Estates subdivision project. Last week, I got a chance to talk to camp spokesperson Skylar Williams about this past year's land reclamation, the recent announcement that the Mackenzie Meadows subdivision has also been cancelled by its developer, and what's next for the ongoing land reclamation at Landback Lane.
Hello, my name is Skylar Williams. I'm a Mohawk from Six Nations and have been the spokesperson for 1492 Landback Lane for the last year now.
Okay. We have some, like actually a bunch of listeners who are outside of the region and might not know too much about your context there. Can you tell us a little bit about Six Nations and how it came to exist as it does?
There's a lot of history here at Six Nations, and I mean, going back to like the Revolutionary War and the Americans and the British, and Six Nations people allied with the Crown, and for doing so, the Six Nations people were allotted a tract of land along the Grand River, 6 miles on either side of that river from the mouth to its source. And so Grand River is in southern Ontario. It starts in a town of Dundalk in the north, which is like kind of northwest of Toronto, and goes down to almost the border by Fort Erie, Niagara area. And it flows into Lake Erie at a town called Port Maitland in the south. And so it is about 350 kilometers long. And yeah, and so that, you know, 20 kilometer wide stretch of land from Dundalk to Port Maitland is quite significant, but also significant for another reason. The idea with Six Nations kind of being placed there was that the tensions between the British and the Americans hadn't quite eased as of yet, and it was a military stronghold because the Six Nations people were very fierce in battle and, you know, were positioned by the British to be, you know, a day's ride from Fort Niagara or Fort Detroit or Fort York. And so as the 1784, there was a treaty signed with the British. There was not a treaty, it was a deed, the Haldimand Proclamation, which deeded the Six Nations that tract of land. And so when War of 1812 came about, there was a big push to get English settlement in Canada. And so the kind of leading up to the War of 1812, there was a big push, you know, not only to come and fight for the crown, but also to, you know, settle Indian country. And so the as Six Nations people started to flood into what was lands that were granted to us, we started noticing a lot of white settlers had started to homestead along the banks of the Grand River. And so we immediately started petitioning to government and trying to, you know, push those settlers on to, you know, other lands. And government at the time, you know, had made lots of you know, promises to get rid of these settlers, but because this War of 1812 was coming, it wasn't something that they were too keen on doing in too big a hurry. As things moved along, the tract became smaller and smaller and smaller, and so from 1812 to, you know, the early 1900s, there was significant amount of encroachment on those lands. So the city of Kitchener and Dunville, Brantford, Cambridge all started springing up along the banks of the river. And so those lands were squatted on and then resold once the Crown patenting land registry was starting in Canada. And so, like, in the mid-1800s, 1850s era, there was all of that started to happen. And so Landback Lane, 1492 Landback Lane, was one of those spots. And so in 1848, a squatter came and seen a little spot of land that he liked along the creek, cleared the land of all the bush and started to farm there. There was a big push right around that time in the 1860s to have these squatters removed. But this particular squatter sold his rights to that land to the Nichols family. And the Nichols family farmed that land until 2003. And it just got passed down from father to son to father to son until, you know, nobody kind of understood anymore that this land was just squatted on one at one point. In 2003, it was sold to a local developer who started working to get bylaws changed. And in 2006, as a development was starting across the road from where we're at right now, Six Nations people came out in a huge way. And so this was the 2006 Caledonia Reclamation and standoff that, you know, has seen Six Nations people occupy those lands at Gunnestado for the last 15 years. And so now, directly across the road from that, last year when development started there, our people went there and we said absolutely no to development.
Yeah. Can you just sort of walk us back to that point pretty much exactly a year ago right now, and let us know quickly how you took control of that spot, what led to that moment, and how 1492 Landback Lane came to be?
So, yeah, I was, and you know what, we've been quite deliberate in the choices that we've made around trying to keep everything as peaceful as we possibly can. And so the first day that we went in there was no different. July 19th, it was about dinner time. We made those choices because we knew that the developers, none of the workers were going to be there that day in the evening. And so we went and we set up a fire and put up some flags, and, you know, we sat down and we had dinner together. There was, I don't know, 30 of us that went in on the first day. And so that was kind of the choosing of that. And, like, that spot, I mean, it is right on the border of what is now, like, Six Nations Reserve number 40. Like, it is the further pushing in and hemming in, if you will, of our community.
The mainstream media always makes a point when they're talking about this to mention that the elected band council of Six Nations at that point was supporting the development. Can you explain for folks what that means and why people chose to oppose it anyway?
So the elected council here at Six Nations, and it's no different to any First Nations community, Indigenous community across the country. Like, the elected council here in Six Nations represents about 4% of our community. And so the last voter turnout, that's exactly what they had in terms of was 4% of the eligible voters. And so this idea that these developers can gain and it's not even consent that they're asking for. And so they're coming and saying, here's a bag of money. We are going to develop this land. And so you can either say no to the money and we're going to develop it anyway, or you can take the money and we're going to develop. So, like, there's no choice for these developers to make here, or these band councils to take. And so there was no consultation with the hereditary council here or, you know, any of the families of these nations within their community.
Will you spell out, just for listeners, what the difference is between band council and hereditary chiefs, and where your camp and the people there kind of fit into that question?
So, yeah, and I mean, like, for us, like, our stance has always been one of unity. Colonization, man, it has really messed with a lot of our nations, and not just here at Six Nations, but, like, across all of Turtle Island. Like, these elected systems that were enforced here in Six Nations in 1924 by, you know, gunpoint by the RCMP that outlawed the hereditary council. And so that they, you know, instigated a coup and installed a puppet government that was, you know, voted on by, I think, something like 60 people. I mean, Six Nations is a reserve of 20,000 people. Like, and I think they had 60 or 70 people that came out to vote the very first election in 1924. And so, like, there's, and the Hereditary Council, which is kind of the more conservative estimates, put it around 1,200 years old. And some of the more larger ones put it much, much, much older than that. And so, and it is a participatory democracy and one of the oldest, if not the oldest, in the entire world. And so it is certainly a means that we govern ourselves and still govern ourselves today.
Let's talk about the encampment. What has, like, you've been there a year. What is life like from day to day at that spot at Lambeck Lane?
Oh, I mean, you know, it's about family and friends and, you know, being able to, these days it's about planting and growing and being able to build, you know, tiny homes so that we can, you know, be sustainable and have our people on the land for the foreseeable future. Very early on, it was difficult. I mean, when just to give a little brief, like, last year in a nutshell, like, after we went in there, the police said that they were going to kind of let sleeping dogs lie, not move in and try and push us off the land. But this developer went and got a civil court order for an injunction to, like, kind of strong arm the police into moving on the camp. And so when that happened on August 5th, Six Nations people, like I said, Six Nations is a huge, huge population and doesn't look too kindly on their people being shot at. And so when the OPP came in, they lined up 120 tactically armed OPP officers and rolled onto the camp, you know, and as they got there, they said, you know, if there's anybody that is willing to leave, you can leave right now and you won't be arrested. And so we went and told everybody what was going on. And so some of those people went to leave. One of those young ladies who was not from Six Nations went to leave. And when they got to the road, the one police officer picked her up and slammed her to the ground. And as all of us kind of stepped forward, say not to do that, shots started to ring out. And so you could hear the bullets whiz by our heads. We learned a few days later that they were rubber bullets. But, you know, it's not an announcement that they make before they start shooting. It's not, hey, these are rubber bullets we're shooting. And, no, it was just starting to fire with what looked to everybody to be shotguns. And so it was quite the day. There was 9 of us arrested that day, including myself. As I got out of jail, about 4 hours later, this woman come running up to me with a phone in her hand, and she stuck it right in my face. And I'll never forget it because I was trying to see who this person was that was talking to me, but she was showing me this live stream from a news outlet that was showing the fires and the roadblocks and the cops being pushed off the land. And so, I just immediately said, like, you know, take me back down there. I got to get back down there. So I got a ride from this woman that I didn't know, and she took me back to the middle of everything. And, all the roads, everything that was keeping us from being able to go back in the Lambeck Lane was now blocked and held by Six Nations people. we marched into Landback Lane, much like we did the very first day. You know, we drove in the front door and peacefully as we did that very first day, you know, and we started to rebuild our camp. And as soon as we were, you know, back reestablished at the camp, we were, you know, started to bring those barricades down. But then also we started fighting the injunction. We fought the injunction. We presented evidence. We argued our case. I was named in the injunction, and so, but we didn't have any money, I guess, to be able to hire a lawyer. I mean, the lawyers to fight these civil cases is, you know, millions and millions of dollars, and so I'm quite lucky in my friends, and so we got some of my smartest friends together, and we decided to figure out how it is to litigate a injunction case. On October 22nd, the judge in Haldimand County, Ontario, barred me from any participation in my own defense, as well as struck every bit of evidence that we put forward to kind of explain why it is that we're there. And then at the court that day, we did a bit of media thing. And as the press conference was over, we made our way to what we call the back door, which is like the kind of the back trail to get into the camp. And as that happened, I drove up, and just as I got there, my wife had called and said, Skyler, you need to get to the back door right now. The cops are here. They're trying to arrest people. And so I said, I'm here. And as I got out of the car, like not a second later, then my door closed and the shot started to ring out again. And again, you know, we found out days later that they were rubber bullets that they were firing. But one young man was shot in the back of the leg. Another guy was shot with a taser dart. But no arrests were made that day. But with the shots ringing out again and again, nobody knowing whether or not it was live rounds or rubber bullets or what it was, Six Nations people came out in a just huge way again. And, you know, CFLs and Six Nations people take to the streets, and that evening, you know, that's roads and railways and highways dug up all the way around the camp to make sure that, you know, the OPP were no longer going to be able to utilize these roads to be able to inflict any more violence on the group of people that, you know, were peacefully occupying their lands. We'll be right back.
You are listening to From Embers on CFRC 101.9 FM, or you might be listening to the podcast edition of From Embers on your smartphone. If you want to hear more, like this interview with Skylar Williams of 1492 Lambeck Lane, we encourage you to subscribe to our podcast. There you'll find all of our past episodes, including an interview with a settler anarchist who spent time at the 2006 land reclamation at Six Nations, as well as an episode about the Oka crisis and its legacy, which I think also provides important context for today's show. All of the music on today's episode is by artists who have performed at one time or another at the camp at Lambeck Lane. You just heard Six Nations singer-songwriter Derek Miller with Rorschach, and the beat that you keep hearing along with my voice is by A Tribe Called Red. Here's the rest of that interview with Skylar Williams. Six Nations is in such a dense area. It's surrounded by so much sprawling colonial development, and this is absolutely not the first time people there have had to defend their land, even specifically against subdivision development. Can you speak a bit to what is different or not now in, like, 2020, 2021 versus years ago?
Yeah, I was a part of a 2006 reclamation, actually. I spent a year in a bush there in a tent, and been 7 months in jail for that particular tract of land that is still occupied by our people. And what is different this time, you know, like, I think there are a lot of similarities. The fact that, you know, it is, you know, Six Nations people driven, and it is, you know, like, these amazing people that, you know, continue to hold it down, the women of our community that, like, continue to, you know, guide that struggle in the way that they do. It really is a gift to be from a community like Six Nations that has these just absolutely amazingly strong women behind us. In 2006, we had, like, some really hard right-wing folks like Gary McHale and his cohort continue to come and antagonize and stir up trouble, whereas we haven't had that this time. You know, we've really done everything possible to make ourselves as open as possible, but, you know, we can have those discussions with people that may disagree with us. But also, like, there's a growing bit of solidarity with non-Native communities, not just here, but across the country. Mm-hmm. Like, it's been an absolutely amazing turn to see, you know, like, those rallies be in support of us as opposed to against us.
Yeah, I mean, it's been, like, a pretty big couple of years for, I think, both for, like, land defense and also for settlers kind of reckoning with Canadian history in various ways. Do you have a lot of supporters showing up here and there? Like, have you seen a lot of people come through, like, to show their support for that? Or, like, or is it sort of the same?
Absolutely. You know what? Last, on July 1st, we actually got some news that the developer was going to be repaying all of the down payments that the would-be homebuyers had made. And so, yeah, to see the celebration that we had that Saturday, you know, we've seen people from all over the place that had made donations, had come down, had helped build things, had helped to organize events, like, had, that, you know, had really been the spearhead of pushing this along to make sure that, you know, that 360 days that we're still there, you know, that after 360 days of us on the land, like, our people are still there. And so this coming weekend, we're going to be having, you know, more people again for the 1 year anniversary on July 19th. And so, like, that sees, like, the kind of who's who of musicians and artists from across Turtle Island here come out. And some of which were actually arrested for coming down last summer and playing their music for us. And so, to see them guys back after having, like, there was another big win in court, 2 days ago that seemed, some 30 people have their charges withdrawn. You know, this is after, you know, 9 months of going to court, being on these conditions to not attend that Lambeck Lane. And so, like, it's just an absolutely ridiculous sentiment that, you know, you can put down a movement just simply by arresting everybody with no intention of proceeding with any charges against them, but keeping them on conditions for, you know, for some of those people, almost a year. And so it is just ridiculous that this is how we try and control people.
Yeah, and we've seen that, like, several times with various different movements, too, how sometimes that process itself is the punishment. Like, they never intended to charge people or convict them of any crime. It's just about holding them up in court while things continue. Do you ever feel like it's overwhelming? Like, there's, like, too many supporters coming through, or, like, more people than you know what to do with trying to lend their support, come out, that kind of stuff?
No, absolutely not. No, it is an absolute gift to be able to have the friends that we have. And, you know, like, it is a beautiful thing, and, you know, would like to extend that invitation to anybody that would like to come and visit us. You know, like, we do our best to be as open a community as we can be.
There was a major raid, like, just a month in, as you mentioned earlier, and I think a lot of folks sort of felt like, oh, wow, like, this is going to be it from the outside. But a year later, you guys are still there. To what do you credit that longevity? Like, how have you lasted so long?
I think it is that openness that we just talked about, is that being able to, you know, be welcoming to folks that want to come down and, you know, and, like, the support that we've had from Six Nations in general. Like, it is, like, the hereditary chiefs have, you know, supported us when they won the elected council here, and some tentative support, and I really can't say enough about how grateful I am for that community that I come from.
You guys aren't the only people really across so-called Canada who've been standing up defending your land this year and the year before. Are there connections between people there and, like, people out west, people out east, people in other places who've also been fighting for their own land in the last couple of years?
You know what? We would not be able to make these struggles real for Canada or for their individual provinces if we weren't able to stand together. And so it is an absolute gift to be able to have the friends and brothers and sisters that we have from Mi'kmaq folks that were fighting for their rights to fish for lobster, Kitigan Vibi folks that, you know, made their stand for the moose moratorium, Inuit folks up north that were fighting there, the Wet'suwet'en folks, and people from all of these communities have made their way to Six Nations to stand beside us and to be able to make that make the point clear that, you know, we are united across the country. And so, you know, just going to one of our communities and arresting, you know, a dozen people here and there, and certainly here in Six Nations where they spent $20 million to do so. Like, we aren't going to lay down. And if you go to wherever, it's going to disrupt things across the country.
Yeah, and I think there really is that growing sense, too, that, like, if they attack people in one place, there's really going to be, like, this wave of stuff across the whole territory. Like, people are going to fight back everywhere, which is, like, I find that really inspiring, at least. I don't know about you guys there. You kind of already gave this away, but last week the developer announced that they're basically giving up on the build. Does that count as a major victory for you guys?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't come as a major victory. I mean, these are incremental wins.
Sure.
The generational struggle, right? Like, this is a struggle that began, you know, many, many, many years ago, and we are just carrying on in the footsteps of those people that, you know, made these stands before us. My parents made these stands, my grandparents and their parents before them. And so it is, there's no court or bit of legislation that is going to, you know, there's going to be some judge someday that's going to stand up and say, all right, everybody, we messed up. Everybody back on the boats. We got to go back to Europe. You know, and so it's, we're just passing down to our children the ability to at least have an argument. Because if we do nothing, if we stand by and and let these massive developments roll through. It takes their ability to even be able to say no. And so it's, I'm really, really grateful, you know, for my parents that made these stands, and my grandparents before them. And so it's, this connection to land is something for us that, you know, is near and dear to all of us. And, you know, like, we've never, you know, when we're not saying, you know, we're going up and down the Grand River evicting people from their homes that, you know, maybe have been passed down from father to son and mother to daughter. Like, this isn't what we're about. What we're about is saying that we would like the ability to be able to grow and thrive. Like every other big city, every other small town across the country has had the ability to grow and thrive as communities. The only ones that have not are reserves. They are the only ones that continue to shrink. And so for us, we want to be able to, you know, certainly while we're talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women, right now we're talking about residential school and the survivors of those schools, the 60s scoop, the Millennium scoop, like all of these children that were stolen from our communities. We want to be able to invite those brothers and sisters home to their families. But we need to be able to have have space to be able to do that. And so for Six Nations, which has a booming population, those borders continue to shrink. Like, we don't have that ability to shrink anymore without having to push those community members into surrounding cities. And so all we want is the same thing that everybody else has had, is that ability to grow and thrive as communities. And so this idea that covering everything in concrete and asphalt in the name of progress is not how folks at Six Nations live. You know, and I think this is true of Indigenous communities across the country, is that, you know, we leave something for the deer and the wild turkeys and the foxes and the, you know, like there needs to be some relative harmony with what's going on around us and with Mother Earth. And so this is how we, like, you come to my house, like, you know, 3/4 of my property is just wild bush. Like this is where we tap maple trees. This is where, you know, I teach my children to hunt and trap. Like, this is how we do things. And so for us to be forced to cover everything in concrete and asphalt, because that's the only way that we can keep members of our community within our communities. Like, this is an absolutely infuriating idea to all of us.
Do you think that a moment like this, where there is, like, this small gain, like this developer is pulling out, do you think that gives people hope for a different future there? Like, is there anything to be gained from a small victory like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think those small victories like we had in 06, you know, like those small victories are very, very important to be able to show that next generation that wants to make these stands, that there isn't, that, like, when you fight, we can win. Mm-hmm. It needs to be done together, and it needs to be done in the name of unity, and it needs to be for everybody.
Does it change what you'll do next at all? Like, now that particular subdivision seems pretty unlikely to happen right away, at least. Like, does the camp stay as it has been? Is there anything that's going to change moving forward because of that?
No, absolutely not. I mean, we're going to continue to grow there, and you know, our community will utilize those lands as we see fit. And so this idea that we're simply borrowing these lands from those future generations. And so my kids, my grandkids, my great grandkids, like, they will decide what it is we utilize those lands for. And so if we're going to have that opportunity to be able to build there and make sure that Nation's people are on those lands for the foreseeable future.
Got any big hopes or plans for the coming months or years out there? Anything in particular that you're looking forward to?
You know, like the when these massive developments, like this particular development is 1,400 homes. So when these developments start and they bulldoze down everything that's beautiful about, you know, Mother Earth, like every shrub, every tree, every blade of grass has been bulldozed over. And so to see this year our gardens to see this year, you know, trees being planted, to be able to witness the community come together in the way that it did, like, to be able to continue to build on that and keep pushing.
CKUT
Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
You're back at CKUT, and this is Off the Hour. That was a segment created by From Embers on 1492 Landback Lane.
And some news that you can use. Solidarity Across Borders is organizing a bus trip to Ottawa this weekend. It's the last event in a week of actions to encourage visibility and support of people without status and to demand status for everyone. The bus will leave Montreal Saturday. Members will camp and march on Ottawa on Sunday. And a petition has been created to ask the city to remove a second fence surrounding a lot on the corner of Milton Park. The second fence is the latest physical barrier in the area where multiple homeless residents live. The city has said that the fence was put up by a private company and that they have no jurisdiction, but supporters want the city to ask the private developer to remove them and provide more support for those in the Milton Park community. The petition has reached almost 3,000 signatures, and you can find it on Instagram. Search for Meals for Milton Park, park spelled with a C.
For a Free Palestine, an evening of films by Palestinian women, on Monday, July 26th. This is a sunset screening, Cinema Politica's first live event since the pre-COVID era. This event will start at 7 p.m. It will take place behind 3729 Jean Mons in the alley. Enter by the parking lot on Saint-Famille, just south of Pine Avenue. That's Monday, July 26th. This event is co-presented by the Dakira Collective, Milton Park Citizens Committee, Projection Insurgée, Academics for Palestine at Concordia University, and Students in Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights at McGill. Info, cinemapolitica.org. This is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes myself, Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, Joel Salmadal, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 7000, or news intern at ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at OffTheHour, or connect with us on Facebook. Just search for us on CKUT. Stay tuned for a cafe coming up next on 90.3 FM.
Free Palestine, an evening of films by Palestinian women, on Monday, July 26th. This is a sunset screening, Cinema Politica's first live event since the pre-COVID era. This event will start at 7 p.m. It will take place behind 3729 Jean Mons in the alley. Enter by the parking lot on Saint-Famille, just south of Pine Avenue. That's Monday, July 26th. This event is co-presented by the Dakira Collective, Milton Park Citizens Committee, Projection Insurgée, Academics for Palestine at Concordia University, and Students in Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights at McGill. Info, cinemapolitica.org. This is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
L'épidémie mondiale de la COVID-19 a affecté les vies de chacun de différentes manières. Elle a également attiré notre attention sur l'intensification du racisme systémique et de la xénophobie sélective envers nos amis racisés dans notre société canadienne. Il est compréhensible que chacun d'entre nous se sente anxieux face à cette maladie dangereuse. Cependant, ce sentiment d'angoisse ne nous donne pas le droit de commettre des crimes de haine et de discriminer nos amis asiatiques, noirs, autochtones et autres personnes racisées. Il n'est pas acceptable d'associer la maladie COVID-19 aux Asiatiques, en particulier à ceux d'origine chinoise. Il n'est pas acceptable